The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, check one, two. Steve Austin coming to you from the top of a hotel on the 35th floor. I tell you what, I'm sitting here with Tommy Dreamer, the innovator of violence. How did he come up with the innovator of violence? I'm about to ask him, but first, here we are. I was coming to New York City I got a new reality television show. It's called The Broken Skull Challenge. It's going to season premiere on July 6th. By the time you hear this, it will have already premiered. But anyway, set your DVRs to check out The Broken Skull Challenge on country music television. And there was one name that came to my mind, because I always love to talk to people in person, and it was Tommy Dreamer. So, short notice, just like everything I do in my life, I called Tommy out of the blue and said, "Hey, man, well, you know how I got your number? I got your number from our mutual friend, Nicole DiRazio."
Nicole used to work
in WWE. I've known her for a long time. She's the one who took care of me and had my ass in every single town and did all my flights and all my stuff for me. So I know she doesn't listen to the show, but cheers to Nicole DiRazio, who was the savior of my entire career that I was with WWF. So here we sit, and you were able to put some time in your schedule for me. What's happening right now? You want to talk about the House of Hardcore? Because I want to start off with the here and now and then go back in time.
You got it. I would love to talk about the House of Hardcore. I want to also talk about this. You know, it's not every day. You called me up the other day. I'm driving. And we
sound as serious as a heart attack. I'm like, man,
yeah,
what the fuck's going on with
let
Tommy?
Let me explain to you. I'm sitting in traffic, and all of a sudden, hey, Steve Austin. I'm like, yeah. In my head, yeah, right, Steve Austin's calling me. It's not that we're not friends. We really don't ever have conversations on the phone. So I'm like, you go, what are you doing? I'm sitting in traffic driving to a show. You don't have to understand. I have been my entire life full of wrestlers. When Austin 316 was the hottest thing going, and beepers were around, my friends, we would get beeps, and it would say 316, and you would look. When you looked at your beeper, you get turned around. Your friend would kick you in the stomach, give you a finger, and give me a stunner.
Right.
So for the fact that you're just calling me random out of the blue, that's why I was like, who's ribbing me now? But then we said, so what's going on, kid? And that kid was like, this really is Steve. I was like, hey, what's up?
Well, I tell you, I started to kind of doubt myself. I was like, man, this somebody's either got a lot of bad things going on in his life or is really not happy to hear from me. Because like I said, we don't just call each other out of the blue. Hey, let's describe our situation.
It's romantic.
It's romantic.
I wish
like a
you had a vagina and a set of boobs, because I'm sitting here in a beautiful downtown West Side Highway, 44th Street, overlooking the theater district. We have the view of the ocean. We have Manhattan at our, and it's the smallest room ever. You're sitting on a crate where you rest your feet. You're sitting here, and you know, but it's okay, because it's not every day when you have Tommy Dreamer knocking on your door. I felt like I was your old girlfriend, and then you opened the door. I was like, ooh, what happened to him?
But it's a rib. I mean, you know, hell, check it out. I checked in this hotel the other day, and we went in and upgraded you to the whatever the gimmick suite thing they call this thing. So I'm thinking, oh, man, this is badass. They give me the upgrade. I come in this motherfucker, and I look. I barely got enough room to turn around. I got my suitcase right there on the floor. It takes up the entire side of the room right there. The bed takes up the rest. I got the
Japanese
one chair.
Japanese-style hotel.
Because
Japanese
you're
style.
The guest of the show, I gave you the Mac Daddy chair, and I'm sitting in this little motherfucker that, like, you know, a kid would sit on, or you put at the end of your bed to put your shoes on.
Yep, it's not the biggest.
So I told my wife, I called her, I said, we're about to start the show. I said, we might just lay on the bed and hold our microphones, because that's where we got the most room.
I promise I will keep my clothes on.
Thank you.
1 foot on the floor at all times. Then it's not sex.
Okay, so check it out, man. We're in, is this downtown, midtown, uptown? Where the fuck are we?
We're right in the middle, again, theater district. You're in the heart of the city. Times Square is a little bit to our left. We're overlooking all these great buildings, and you got some views going on here.
It's a pretty good view. I'm digging. I've got this stretch right here. You can see all the cars. A bunch of yellow cars, a lot of cabs in this city. I had the damn room service people bring me 5 Sierra Nevada pale ales. They didn't have the torpedo, so I got 5 pale ales. Of course, Tommy ain't got a drink in his hand because he's got to drive home later. But here we sit. And, dude, you're from, what, this neck of the woods right down
Yonkers,
the road?
Yonkers, New York, born and raised.
So you're at home right now, man. I mean, it's like I come to New York City to do what I got to do, and I'm promoting something this time around. But, dude, with all due respect to the city, with 2 or 3 days here, I'm ready to get the fuck out. So this is just another day at the office for you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really get into the city that much. And during the holidays, I'll take my kids. You know, we go see the Christmas tree every year. And, you know, there's tons of stuff to do. You go to Madison Square Garden, you know, see a concert or whatever. But
are you a concert-going guy? Well, I mean, like, okay.
Again, I don't
do
anything.
No, you said it, so then who are you going to go see in concert?
I don't
tell me Bon Jovi.
I know. I don't remember the last concert. Normally, if I go out, it's usually like if there's a wrestler in town or like, hey, meet me here, meet me there.
Who comes to town that you go check out?
Bully Ray. Me and him, we always hang out. He's a concert guy. You know, there's always just something. We're strip club guys, too. We'll always go to different strip clubs.
You still go to strip clubs?
Well, yeah, it's a good place where fans won't bother us because they're looking at the ladies.
Right.
The last time I went out probably in the city was for Bully Ray's bachelor party to Brooke Hogan, which was awesome because it was a fake wedding, but we had a real bachelor party for it.
I like that.
It's just a reason to go out.
I like that.
Yeah, it's just a reason to go out.
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, you're thinking shoot, but you're working.
Always. 100. It's still real to me, bro.
So you were just talking, and you live, man, how many miles is it to your house?
From my house, 11 miles, sometimes in traffic.
Well, goddamn, the way you talked, I thought it was taking you like an hour and a half to get here.
With traffic. There's something called traffic. I don't know where we're
okay,
the Broken
but how
Skull
can you
Ranch.
Be 11 miles from here, but you said you back up to like 6,000 or 20,000 acres or
because
something?
Because this is – I live in Westchester County. We're the highest tax county in America. We have the most millionaires per capita. I am not one of them, but I pay the highest taxes for them. My backyard ends where, and we have 6 miles of nature preserve. I could walk to the New York. It's like an aqueduct, a reservoir, and I got animals. I got deer. I got
shit,
a bunch
man.
Of,
do you go deer hunting in the woods?
I do not kill animals. That's where you and I are the only problem. The only place where we usually get along. Don't get
hey,
along.
Man, if you go now, see, I'm an old country boy coming here to the city. Country boy can survive. I've got a shotgun, a rifle, and a 4-wheel drive. What if I came over to your house and could we catch some fish in the aqueduct, or is that just water? Maybe probably some alligators, because I always hear about people flushing alligators and they get them on a little bit of baby
things.
You are
very much a redneck. That is not happening.
It doesn't. You're going to tell me out of all these people, Tommy, look.
I'm not saying it doesn't have they cannot survive in the sewer. I know they actually just found some great white in New Jersey, and there's some great white off the Long Island Sound.
Boy, I tell you what, there got to be some unhealthy great white sharks because there's got to be so much pollution in these surrounding waters. It's unbelievable.
No, you don't want to go swimming. It just looks nice. Actually, if this was your house, you would pay more money because they would consider that a water view, even though you could barely see it.
But and to the listeners out there, the Steve Austin Show, when Tommy was given this panoramic description of all the beauty that is the Broadway district of New York City, you can see a cunt hair's worth of water right where that building in the middle down there splits it up.
It's like the scenic of Friends, except we have a guy from New York and a guy from Texas.
Hey, you see that thing down there that keeps flashing 50 Shades?
Yes.
Did you read that book?
No. I don't.
Did you hear about the book?
No, I only read wrestling. My life is still 100% wrestling. I'm probably the biggest fan. I only read wrestler books. I just finished.
But did you hear about the series of books? And it was changing people's sex lives because I guess the women read the books, they get all juiced up, and I guess they want to fuck their husbands more.
Awesome.
My wife read all three books. I ain't fucking no more before she read the sumbitches or after.
No.
So I don't know if it's just, is it a work or is it a shoot?
Well, I guess
you don't know because you read wrestling books.
Yes, I
tell me the last wrestling book you read.
Stan Hansen.
How was it?
It was pretty good. I read it. It was a little long. Before that, I was reading about the Montreal territories.
Yep. How did that grab you? Because did you remember all the names? Some of them ring a bell. I know Rougeau's, people like that. But
no, I basically, if you know, I do. I wrestle every single weekend. I'm actually just coming off 5 days of wrestling straight and. Whenever I go to indie shows, there's have little vendors, and I'll see a book, and I'll be like, I want that book. And
do you consider yourself any bit of a wrestling historian?
100%. I've been a wrestling fan since I'm 9 years old. I have every wrestler, Inside Wrestling and Pro Wrestling Illustrated from 1979 till 1992, and then I only started buying them if my name was in it. Then, you know, I was getting a big head, and then if there was just a picture of me, I still only buy them if there's a picture of me. But they cost like $10 now.
Right.
So, yes, I do consider myself a wrestling historian. I have never lost the wrestler name game.
Really?
Yep, never lost.
Explain to my fans the wrestling
name. The wrestling name game. We sit on the cars. We used to drive all the time.
And this is a time-killing exercise.
We would sit there, and I played a little differently, and there have been fights because of this game. I have gone 9 hours straight playing this game where it was held to a draw, but I have yet to physically lose the game.
Okay, explain the rules and how this works.
We are driving down the road. We play the wrestling name game. You would say Steve Austin, and then it is my job to come up with a person's name who begins with the letter A, so I would say Arn Anderson. To add my own Tommy Dreamer twist to it, then you would have to say two wrestlers with the name A, because I said Arn Anderson. So if you said Austin Aries and Awesome Kong, oof, that's, you know, messes you up. And then it would be my turn to say, well,
At that time, it only goes back to one name.
Correct. But if I would have said Austin Aries and another guy with two, it would be four. The greatest game ever, Christian, that creepy little bastard, you know him.
CLB.
He named 13 Ks once in one drive. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this was after 4 hours. Christian and I have traveled together, and he would never want a room with me because he's just, I don't know, he likes to get his own room. But yet, he would always call me to his room to rub Tanner on his back. And so I would go to my room. Dude. He didn't need to split money. He was rich.
The innovator of violence in there. In
it's not gay. It's pro wrestling all the time. Okay. But there always was that moment when I would touch his back, and he would be, you know, he didn't shave his back every once in a while, and you still get the, oh man, this is still weird, bro. I love you like my brother, but this is weird. And he'd always like text me, "Could you please come to my room and put Tanner on or the lower back?" So I was responsible for his. And it was funny. Edge would always be like, "Dude, you're the dirtiest tan. Like, you don't look like you're tan. You look like you're dirty." But that's because I was putting on.
A couple of times I noticed that his back looked a little splotchy. And now I know the backstory to how and why that happened.
The longest game ever of the wrestler name game was myself, Paul Heyman, Chris Candido, and Sonny driving to Lake Placid during the original ECW invasion. And we played for 9 hours. We had to stop the game, and we continued it. And Paul Heyman was disqualified.
Now, how do you get disqualified playing
well,
a name game?
Because you can say Joe Smith,
and
he'd be like, "He was an independent wrestler from 1930 and the NWA champion." And this is before smartphones and all that stuff. So we disqualified him for that.
Okay, got you.
But now we have the rules that you can't go to your phone. But if there is a discrepancy, because, I mean, again, there's also a lot of independent wrestlers.
Right.
And so if there's a discrepancy where, like, I don't know about the guy, we go to Google, and then you Google the guy's name.
Right.
So I've never lost. There has been. Bubba has had me on the ropes. Matt Stryker has had me on the ropes. Christian has had me on the ropes. Christian and I have actually sat in our rooms and text each other answers back and forth. That's how nerdy wrestling fans we are. So to say I'm a wrestling fan, I'm a proud wrestling fan.
Okay.
I love wrestling.
So Christian likes to get his rooms by himself.
He didn't want to room with me.
I know, but you've come back. You've come up the hard way.
Yes,
you had to pay a lot of dues and room with a bunch of dudes. So now these days on the road, if you get out there, you try to room by yourself. You travel with a group of people because, you know, once you kind of started making a little bit of money in the business, I'm a loner, man. I always wanted to have my own room, but I always couldn't afford my own room. So these days, is it just now a part of the process that's still ingrained in you? Hey, get a bunch of dudes in the room.
No, with me, when you work independent wrestling, you're normally the only guy.
Right.
You know, you don't know a lot of people, so it's just me. But I was always those guys. I'll cram five into a room. With this room tonight, I would cram five guys into. If they needed to sleep on the floor, let them save some money. I love the camaraderie. I love the business. Some of my favorite times are just chilling in rooms or, you know, I've had some craziness going on. You know, a lot of things happen on the road.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a strip club, you bring the entire strip club back to your room. There's an orgy going on in the corner. That was my life since I'm 18. You never know what happens. And I love all the debauchery. I love every single bit about it. You know, that camaraderie is what you miss. And it's, you know, also what, as they would always say, you learn your greatest things in the car. You know, you talk about the matter. I mean, you think about it. I used to ride with Paul back and forth all the time. And
right.
I mean, that's where I learned so much. And it was, you know, it was a great, amazing time of my life. And even still, when I sit in cars with, you know, independent wrestlers, my life is I will get on an airplane. Some total stranger usually picks me up. And normally they were a fan or they tell me stuff. And I'm with this person for the next, you know, few hours if the shot is, you know, wherever. And They take me to my hotel. They, you know, drive me back to the airport the next morning. So, I mean, I'm still very, very, you know, into that whole camaraderie. And, you know, I'm
now, back in the day when you guys were cramming a bunch of dudes in a room, I've been there. Now, normally, like, take, for instance, for a while, it was myself, Mick Foley, and Diamond Dallas Page. Chronologically, Diamond Dallas Page was the oldest cat in the room, but the youngest guy in the business. So, therefore, because he was a young guy on a totem pole, he always got to pull away a bit.
Yeah.
And then we always split the room on even. But so how would you work the seniority status in regards to who got the bed?
No, it was mine. I would always pull. My back hurts. You know, I mean, I broke my neck. I broke my back. I never had a surgery. So I really can't sleep on the floor. And so most guys would always give me the bed. Or me and Matt Stryker just shared a bed. We were in Seattle. We went to the Mariners game. And I put the pillow in between us.
Yeah.
And I said, dude, you roll over towards me, or if you snore, I'll punch you in the face. Or when I'm on the road with TNA, I'll, you know, share a room. Me and Bubba have shared rooms.
Okay, let me stop you. Hypothetical situation, you and Stryker laying in bed.
Yeah.
Let that breathe for a second. So you and Stryker laying in a bed. He reaches over, inadvertently touches you. You said you would punch him in the face. Working punch?
I would probably super kick and slap the leg.
My wife and my niece just went to Mexico, and they were supposed to have two double beds. Of course, they messed up the room, and so they were stuck in a king, and they were going to wait on the double to open up. But they had such a great room with regards to being right by the swimming pool in the ocean, they decided to stay there. So my niece is very, very cute. She's a sweetheart. She's 21. But when they first got there, because there's a lot of older dudes showing up with younger gals, they thought my wife and my niece were a couple of dykes.
Nice.
So then when they built up the ledge, like you said, they rolled up a towel and made the divider of the bed. Then all of a sudden everybody understood what the deal was. Yep.
You know, it's funny. I remember we were in Fort Smith, Arkansas. This was in TNA. And it was me, Bubba, and Bobby Roode. Bubba has a sleep disorder. He walks in his sleep. He talks in his sleep.
He snores.
Is he as loud?
Because Bubba's a loud human being. He's been doing some great work down there in TNA with regards to his promos and stuff. But is he a loud sleep talker or like one of those
people? He snores like he's trying to swallow the entire bed.
Right.
Bobby Roode has night terrors every once in a while.
What's a night terror?
You'll be sitting there. He'll be like,
night terrors are like waking up.
That is a night terror. So
that's
I'm
night terror.
Sitting in the bed with Bubba, who sounds like he's. And Bubba will sit up and give you a hard look. And the first time I ever roomed with him, it was me.
Give me the stink eye.
Me, him, and Mikey Whipwreck, and he was hovered over Mikey Whipwreck, and he was about 415 pounds.
Right.
And I hear Mikey Whipwreck in the corner go, Tommy, help. And Bubba's looking at him like he wants to kill him.
Yeah.
So Bubba will be looking at me and be like, you fat dick, go to fucking bed, you know, lay down.
Yeah.
And he'll just be snoring unconscious. And Bobby's in the other, you know, we got a suite. Bobby's on the pullout, screaming, having night terrors. And I'm like, I'm not fucking going to go to sleep at all tonight. But, yeah, I mean, again, those are times on the road. A lot of times I would room with Hornswoggle. Me and Edge would room together. Every once in a while, Edge would give me a naked Superfly Jimmy Snuka splash from across the bed, which was always, you know, fun.
Interesting.
It's, hey, when there's nothing wrong with it when two guys are naked and splashing each other when you include wrestling. Rhino is one that me and him have been best friends forever. Rhino is a germaphobe, and I am a filthy man. And that,
really?
Yeah, I'm kind of dirty.
You cleaned up pretty good for the podcast.
No. I just, it's my room. You know, if I want to spit on the floor, I'll spit on the floor. I don't do that when I'm sharing rooms with a guy.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Dude, you really spit on the floor?
Sometimes I don't.
Or you just make it a point.
I make it a point.
Yeah, gotcha.
Sometimes I do pee in the sink just because I can.
Oh, well, I'll piss in the shower.
Yeah, see? Well, no, I will actually piss in the sink. I used to room with Spike all the time. But Rhino is a germaphobe. I'm kind of, you know, a messy. So we go, we're sharing, we're in the same hotel for two nights, and I pick up a towel, and I wipe my face with it, and it smells like asshole. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? And then he's like, he folded all the dirty towels. And I would just take a towel and shove it under the sink. And I said, dude, I just wiped my face with your ass. And I said, what did you fold the towel for? And he goes, well, it's, you know, for the maid. I said, no, that's what a maid does. She comes and takes these towels away. So, and then he gets mad if I would walk to his side of the room. He's like, what are you doing? That's my side.
Right.
So when he would go into the room, I would dive on his bed naked, take off all my clothes. He'd come out. I'd be wiping my ass, like scooting across it like a dog. I'd rip all his proteins and throw them all on the floor. So him and I don't room together much anymore.
I don't know how much more of the conversation I could take. Let's shift to whatever happened to Rhino.
Rhino just came back in House of Hardcore. House of Hardcore. I've been using it for House of Hardcore. He just came back in TNA.
Let's talk about House of Hardcore, because did that originally start as your school to teach or people learn professional wrestling, and now you turned it into your promotion?
Correct.
And you're doing indie shots.
Yes.
But, I mean, you're doing the shots.
Yes.
Hey, tell me about the promotion game before we get into House of Horror, because back in the day, you know, when I started wrestling, I went to USWA in Tennessee, and I wasn't making shit. I was making $15, $20 a night, and we was driving, you know, 200 miles each way to do our business, and they were just putting gas in my car. And it was always the thing, you know, all the boys wanted to end up being just like Jerry Jarrett. You know, hey, man, we're making enough money, we'll start our own promotion, have our own shows. Well, and most people that did that end up going broke. So what's the secret for success, and how have you found your endeavor into it? Because I know you've kind of been a guy who's really done about everything there is to do in the business,
right,
from the top to the bottom, putting up rings, putting up posters, learning, you know, the ins and outs of the ring, too. So
I guess my reputation with the fans coming from ECW and helping with the booking, and then, you know, going to WWE and working in the office and, you know, helping write pay-per-views and be on creative, and then going to TNA, doing the same thing, and just then my own. I always wanted to do one, and I said if one was successful, I'd do another. And it was proposed to me by my two trainers. They're two independent wrestlers, Vic Delicious, Hale Collins. And they're very, very tied into the area up in Poughkeepsie, New York. It's about an hour from my house. And they're both managers of gyms up there. And they said, hey, we got to travel into the city, or there's no wrestling schools around there. We want to open a school, but we want to attach your name to it. And I said, well, if you're going to attach my name to it, I have to be there. And so we worked out a deal. I have a free wrestling school. I don't pay rent to run it. I run it in the Mid-Hudson Civic Center where I used to shoot Monday Night Raw.
Right.
And then my payoff for there was that I have to run a wrestling show. And I did my first show. It was very successful, and it's been steamrolling. I'm up to six now, and I did my first show October 6, 2012, and I've had three return dates from in Poughkeepsie. Then I went to Philly, which is a natural progression for me. 2 weeks ago, we did a West Coast invasion right off north of San Diego. It was a sold show for me, and
right.
It was a big convention, had a lot to do with a trading card company, so all the guys made their own deals. And the guy said, I just also want to put on a wrestling show. And now I've been in, you know, really good. They want to bring me back. I've also been talking with a few other people that maybe want to go further. I don't want to expand too soon. I would love to take over the world, but I've seen too many errors and mistakes. And again, learning from the business, you see so many guys. This is my money. Every time I run a show, my wife wants to kill me because, you know, I have two kids and, you know, I don't want to tap into their college funds, and I'm not going to be like a money mark in the sense of, you know, burn through because I want to run a wrestling show. But I'm looking at this as business.
Well, tell me about your wrestling school, because I get people all the time. They send me questions. They always ask me. They send emails to questions@steveaustinshow.com. You guys keep sending the questions because I read each and every single one of them. Okay, you're in the Northeast. People ask me all the time, where is a reputable place to learn how to wrestle?
Yep.
So would that be your school?
That would be my school.
Tell me about, what was it, Vic Delicious, and I missed the other name.
Hale Collins, they're my trainers.
Okay,
and,
so how long
myself,
they been working?
Vic was in OVW. He was one of those guys that was, he could do everything in the ring. He was like a mini Bill DeMott, and I still call him a mini Bill DeMott. But unfortunately, he's not the tallest guy.
Right.
Hale Collins was trained by my trainer, Johnny Rods, and he is good-looking kid, 29 years old, should be in the WWE, 6'2", great body, except he can't talk. And so, but again, then he also got to the point where they both have really, really good jobs, and there comes a point in your life where you say, hey, WWE, I don't think we'll look at him at 29 years old. So, you know, they're content. I know if WWE or I just got one of them a tryout, with TNA, but you know, there's not a lot of places to work out there.
Okay,
so.
Now what do you charge for someone to go through your wrestling program? How long does the program last, and how's it structured?
It's for life. I charge. We have different payment packages. I would like to say, it's $3,000,
right.
But it's $2,500 if you pay up front. It's $3,000 if you pay monthly. It's $100 a month. I want to start doing the credit card thing because there's a lot of people who show up and then you teach them a little bit and then they run away.
Right.
I'd want to say wrestling schools, reputable, would be mine. The Dudleys down in Florida, Lance Storms in
yep.
Calgary. And it's funny, people. I mean, I remember when I started there, you didn't know how to get into the wrestling business, and now there's a wrestling school everywhere. And you don't know how you're going to get started. Now you just go online and just, I could go this guy. But to me, if you've never heard of this person, then how are you going to wonder about them
right.
training you?
There's really no time limit on your school.
No. I mean, I have a few students that make it in the sense of now they're out there, they're doing independent wrestling. It's the shitty thing about wrestling is a lot of people first think they can do it.
Right.
And there's also... there's places out there that they will take a person's money and then go sell me a bunch of tickets and I'll put you in the ring. And these kids are horrible. And forget about the physical dangers of actually doing that.
Right.
But they're just, I want to say, they're almost money grabs.
Right.
And, I wasn't allowed, Johnny Rods trained me. I wasn't allowed to have my first match. When he told me I was having my first match, I sold 50 tickets just because I wanted, people to see me.
Right.
Even with my students, I tell them, I'll give you $1 a ticket for every ticket that you sell. And so I had one kid, my first show, he sold me 87 tickets. So he made 87 bucks.
Right.
Plus I gave him 20 bucks because he wrestled. He walked away with a bigger pay than I made, in my entire ECW career. No, but
let's get to ECW just a second.
I don't think we have enough time to talk about this.
We're gonna hit the highs and lows and some stuff in between. You mentioned Johnny Rods. I've talked to a lot of people, and Johnny Rods was the guy that trained him. How long did it take you to make it through his course, and how would you what grade would you give him?
Oof, Johnny was an amazing trainer then. He still has his wrestling school. I don't know if he still gets in the ring. He was my class. The guys who came out of my school were Damien Demento, who at the time he was the next it guy. He was, the next Road Warrior. He had the amazing look, Bill DeMott, Taz, myself. After me was Big Vito, Angel of the Baldies, Devon Dudley. Matt Stryker trained there. I mean, Matt Stryker, I want to say, was the last of the guys who Johnny would seriously get
hands
in.
On,
but
right.
Johnny, man, he would get in the ring and he'd wrestle, and he had to be my age now. I'm 43. He would wrestle Damien Demento for an hour, Bill DeMott, Taz, and myself for a half hour. He would never get in the ring. I mean, he would never get out of the ring, and he would stretch us. But he would also stretch you to help you, teach
right.
you. He was an amazing bumper, and that was his job in WWE. He was Vince Sr.'s shooter, as well as see what the guys had. But he would lay on you, lean on you, and again, he would not get out of the ring for 2 hours.
Right.
And Johnny, he taught you the right way: rolls, bumps. Then I remember one time, I rammed Damien Demento's head into the turnbuckle, and a screw cut him. And I stopped and went, "Oh, Phil, you're bleeding." And he punched me right in the mouth because I stopped, and it was during my comeback.
Right.
And he goes, "And now you're bleeding,"
Yeah.
And I don't believe in training that way.
Right.
I don't believe in taking someone who doesn't know what they're doing and shooting on them and stretching
right.
them. I believe everyone should. Lance Storm had told me, "I wish every wrestler now actually was in a real fight because they would know how to sell. They would learn how to
right.
be tough." There's not a lot of guys who have there. Or you have, I have this one kid, his name is Ben Ortiz. He's a corrections officer. He's 13-3 in amateur fighting. He's 300 pounds. He's down from 360. His body's like Samoa Joe.
Right.
And I told him, "You're not super tall. You need to lose weight." And I'm telling you to lose weight not because of what I vision wrestling, but if you want to try to take it to the next level or get another, get somebody to look at you seriously, or go to Japan, that's how I try to tell guys, I don't want to crush anybody's dream. You never, but I mean, right now in wrestling, there's only really two places to make it.
Right.
And if you're not blessed with height and you're not blessed with a great body, you better become the best in-ring performer that you can, so anybody wants to use you. And that's kind of where I tell guys.
Interesting. I get a lot of the emails that people send in to me, and everybody wants to get into wrestling. But, I mean, to Tommy's point, you need to take a real honest, hard look at yourself, seeing what you're bringing to the table and seeing if it's really a viable option. Now, it's one thing if you just want to get out of independence and yep. work and just do it because you want to have fun. Whole different ball game if you're really trying to make a living paying your bills.
It's not worth it to your body physically.
Right.
I've had some guys get severely hurt. I have one kid, he did two tours with the Marines. He over-rotated on a backdrop. He snapped his ankle, and it was pretty brutal. He's now coming back, but he's afraid. And I told him, listen, if you're going to continue to do this to your body, this stuff hurts. I mean, you broke your neck. I've broke my neck. I broke my back. I've yet to have a surgery, but this is real.
Okay.
And you don't want to wake up, in all this pain and not to have any money, or look at it where, hey, I tell every independent wrestler I meet, there's nothing wrong with being an independent wrestler. You're pursuing your dream. And somebody may, it's a great feeling to sign an autograph, take a picture with somebody, and someone may have paid to see you wrestle, which is a great feeling. But if you don't have a regular job or if you don't, there's, like you said, take it serious or don't do it at all because then it's not worth it to you, your family, or your physical well-being.
How long were you in Johnny Rod's school before he said, hey, kid, you ready for your first match?
3.5 months.
3.5 months.
You have to understand, every Monday, every Monday and Tuesday, I was the first there and the last to leave.
Right.
I was there from 12 to 7, and this is all I've ever wanted to do. I wanted to be third base for the New York Yankees, and then I saw Bob Backlund wrestle, and it was a whole other story for me.
All right. Talking about being a professional baseball player and I saw Bob Backlund wrestle, I'm coming right back with Tommy Dreamer after a word from our sponsors.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Grow grass fast with Scott's Turf Builder Rapid Grass. It's a revolutionary mix of seed and fertilizer that grows full green grass in just weeks. It helps you solve your lawn's large problem areas and establishes new grass in no time. Seed and feed your lawn back to the top of its game fast, so you can speed your way to enjoying it. Pick up a bag of Scott's Turf Builder Rapid Grass today. It's guaranteed or your money back. Feed your lawn. Feed it.
Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, coming right back with the Tommy Dreamer on Twitter. All right, so here you are, you're a kid growing up, and you're a big baseball fan, so you want to play third base for the Yankees.
Yep, that's all I wanted to be a baseball player. Then my father was a big Rangers fan. Rangers, Canadians game is...
You're talking about New York Rangers, the hockey team.
Is snowed out on Channel 9 here in New York, so they show wrestling from Madison Square Garden, and a wrestler named Bulldog Brower came to the ring. And here comes Bob Backlund. Bob Backlund, I was hooked. My life changed at that moment. And I saw
him. How old were you?
I was 9 years old.
Okay.
2 months later, for my birthday, my father takes me to the Westchester County Center, White Plains, New York. I see Bob Backlund defend the WWF title against Cowboy Bobby Duncombe. And I remember Bob Backlund snapped my hand going to the ring, and I had a power. And coming back, I made a sign for Mr. Backlund and said, Bob Backlund, number one. And because I wasn't the smartest kid, it took me two pieces of loose leaf to whatchamacallit, tape it together.
Yeah.
I said, Bob, can you sign this for me? He said, kid, hang out for me. I'll sign it for you. Awesome. So now I'm sitting there secure. He's like, hey, you got to go. And I said, whoa, Bob Backlund is going to sign this for me. He goes, well, the wrestlers leave right out that door. So go. That gives up right where the wrestlers leave. So now it's February. It's sleeting outside. For some reason, crazy 9-year-old Tommy Dreamer did not want Bob Backlund, his new best friend, to see him with his father. So I made my father go off to the distance, and I had my best friend. He sat in the car. It's sleeting. Here came Arnold Skolin. He gave me my first ever wrestler autograph, which I still have. And then almost like the Mean Joe Green or Bret Hart commercial from back in the day, I see Bob Backlund walking towards me. And he's got the towel, he's got the satin jacket, just like you see on television. It's myself, two weirdo wrestling fans, and probably four what now I would decipher as groupies.
Right.
Waiting for Mr. Backlund, but he just blew. He walks out, and he's like, hey, guys, take care. And I go, no, 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 Bob, can you sign this for me? And he hit me with the most influential words that shape in my life. And he said, I'll get you next time, kid. And I went, no, 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 Bob, it's me. Can you sign this for me? And he was like, take care, kid. Got in the car. Arnold Skolan pulled the car right up, closed the thing, and drove off. I was devastated. I was crushed. I got in the car. I remember like looking at my father.
Did your father chase him down?
No. My father probably would have wanted to kill him. But Bob would probably have shot on my father. And,
Yeah.
But I didn't want to cry in front of my friend. And as soon as my father dropped my friend off, I started crying. I never forgot that feeling. And, I mean, I guess that's kind of why I had this connection with fans. Because, I mean, I've gone out of my way to sign for fans. And you know, if you have 2,000 fans you got to sign for, you sign for all 2,000. But I never forgot that.
So now all these years gone by, what do you think of Bob Backlund?
Hang on. 30 years later.
You still ain't got that fucking sign, do you?
Bob Backlund, my friend, is his manager. Yeah. He says, hey, we're driving by. You want to go meet Bob? I said, sure. Now, I met Bob my first ever tryout in WWF 1992. He just said, hello, goodbye, Mr. Backlund. You know nothing. Then he did a shoot run-in in ECW in Poughkeepsie in the Mid-Hudson Civic Center. And we had Atlas Security throw him out of the building.
Now, what do you mean a shoot run-in?
He is crazy and did a shoot run-in, 1990-whatever. He comes to the show, and Paul Heyman, I guess, was president of his fan club, as well as Paul was president of the fan club of Grand Wizard, Lou Albano, and Freddie Blassie. And Paul, he shows up, and he wants to – he's talking to Paul about doing a promo. And Paul's like, Bob, I'd love to have you, but it's 15 minutes before the show. And – he's like, you know, if you would have called me beforehand, he's like, well, no, I don't want to do anything wrestling. I want to talk about politics. I'm running for office in Connecticut. And Paul's like, well, Bob, this is New York, and, you know, I really can't put you on the show. And Bob's like, well, I really want to. He's like, Bob, I'll try to figure something out, but I can't. No problem. Bob Backlund leaves. Now I'm watching the show, and we're sitting there, and we have a little table. There's a monitor. Paul's got the headset on, and I'm watching. I like to experience everything from the crowd. Here comes a guy's entrance, and as I'm watching from the crowd, from the top of the building, I see Bob Backlund holding a sign that says, vote for Bob Backlund.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, now I'm writing the shows with Paulie, and I know what's going on, and I say, Paul, why do you have Bob Backlund doing a run-in? And he goes, I don't. And I said, Bob Backlund's coming to the ring. And he says, no, he's not. And I, like the Wizard of Oz, I pull over the curtain and I point to Paul over the headset to Atlas. Get fucking Bob Backlund out of the building! So Atlas Security swarms on Bob, then they get Bob Backlund out of the show. So again, I don't want to tell Bob Backlund this because I'm going to go and have a meeting with him, you know, with my friend 30 years later. So I was 39 years old. We started a pizzeria at my house. And I tell Bob Backlund the story about how he snubbed me.
Yeah.
I go, Bob, listen, I've lived your life. You can't sign everyone's autograph. But I go, but there was only about 8 of us there. You could have signed mine. Ha ha. And his face turned beet red. I had a great conversation with Bob. So that Tuesday, to my house, the old school black and white Bob Backlund holding up the championship belt comes to my house in an envelope. And it says, to my number one fan, Tommy Dreamer, hope this makes up for it, Bob Backlund.
Wow.
And we've been great friends ever since. So
what
we buried the hatchet.
Story.
30 years later, I buried the hatchet with Bob Backlund. I hated his guts.
That's awesome.
Was at Madison Square Garden when the Iron Sheik beat him, and I was the only kid who cheered. I used to go to the Garden all the time. I mean, I was at WrestleMania 1. I was the biggest mark, man. I couldn't get
who
enough
of this.
Who
were your favorites growing up? Okay, we know you're a Bob Backlund fan. But
no, I hated Bob after that. Bob was the worst.
Oh, yeah, you hated him. But so who were some of your favorites that you grew up on?
My father was a school teacher and a principal. He would have the summers off and winter vacation. 2.5 months after my first show, we go down to Florida. And my father takes me to the Hollywood Sportatorium, and I see Florida Championship Wrestling.
Jesus, that must have been great.
I purchased my first ever 8x10, a bloody Dusty Rhodes pitcher with the cowbell. My first ever wrestler t-shirt, which I still have.
Damn.
Barry Windham, The Kid Is Hot Tonight. I saw Barry Windham versus Jimmy Garvin for the Florida title. I saw Manny Fernandez wrestle, and the main event was Dick Murdoch and Ivan Koloff. He just turned on his best friend, Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
Versus Dusty Rhodes and Bugsy McGraw. They hit the ring with garbage can and a broom. Dusty bled, and it was the greatest night of my life. And so Dusty was my guy, but yeah. I was a great fan because I loved the good guys.
So what did you think about that time of wrestling? Because the Florida brand was different than the New York brand you were growing up on.
I was middle class, upper right. middle class. I had something called cable. My deal I made with my parents, every Tuesday night, Wrestling from Florida aired on the Spanish channel at 11 o'clock at night.
Are you shitting me?
And I used to watch it. My mother, every Wednesday, my deal was if I didn't wake up on time to go to school, I wouldn't be able to watch wrestling next week. So every Wednesday, I got up early. I was tired as could be. But Tuesday nights, I'd be watching wrestling. We had Southwest Wrestling here on the USA Network. I was one of the first houses to have cable. I watched everything. I would do Little League.
Dude, that's funny because, I mean, back in those days, I mean, for the most part, you got what you had in your territory,
no,
in your area.
Not here. I had everything. I had Mid-South. I had Georgia Championship Wrestling. I had Florida Championship Wrestling.
Did you have World Class?
I had World Class.
Mid-South was doing some good stuff. You had to love the loaded Gucci yep. bag and all that stuff.
I had World Class. I had every single thing. The only thing I did not have, I had the AWA. The only thing I didn't have, and I'm getting all this info. I was a subscriber to The Wrestler, Pro Wrestling Illustrated. So the only thing I didn't have was Memphis. And then my friend worked at a video store, and he was getting all these tapes. He's like, it's called tape trading. And I'm like, huh? So right. now I'm sending VCR stuff. And the best was I would send this guy 6 hours of WWE squash matches, right. and he's sending me 6 matches of Memphis. Bramble 6 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
At brawls and, you know, yeah. Mid-South Coliseum. So I couldn't get enough. And living up here was a great place during that time because I saw everything.
Okay, you saw everything and you saw all the other promotions. So then really give me your top three territories that, you know, as you grew up that you favored.
Florida Championship Wrestling, Mid-South, World Class, but the entire, I have to say anything NWA was me. When I got into wrestling, I did not want to go to, and I started learning about the business, I did not want to go to WWF. I wanted to go to Japan or I wanted to go to WCW because right. those were the working territories, right. you know, where WWF at the time was all, you know, characters and stuff like that. You know, the NWA is where you want to go. I mean, Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Right.
I still, to this day, I watch one wrestling match a night. I'm ridiculous. If I have an obscure reference or I think of something, I will go, like tonight, because I'm here with you, I will watch something Steve Austin.
Right.
And just to make me still love something that I've loved for so long. And, you know, I'll turn around and the next second be like, oh, it's 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm still on YouTube watching right. wrestling. I should be watching porn or watching something else. But no, I'm watching wrestling like a maniac and, you know, you're still learning and still
doing
anything.
One promotion you did not mention was Houston Wrestling from Paul Bosch.
I never got that.
Okay.
I only would get that from tapes.
Right.
But that wasn't national, you know. They would show it every once in a while, you know, through World Class, or they would show it,
right.
you know, Junkyard Dog
is coming
here.
So when did you decide that you had to be a wrestler?
9 years old.
9 years old. Okay, you go through the school. You end up getting a little start. It's a little like an IC. What was it?
IWCCW.
It's hard for me to say it because I'm used to saying
International World Class Championship Wrestling.
So, but you started off as a young TD Madison, white meat babyface.
Yeah, well, I started off as Tommy Dreamer, and then there was a guy there whose name was GQ Madison. They wanted to make us, you know.
Oh, so that's where the Madison.
So they put the TD in front, you know, Tommy Dreamer Madison, and
so you always had the Tommy Dreamer name in your back pocket. How'd you come up with that name? Because were you indeed paying tribute to Dusty Rhodes?
It was always my dream to be a wrestler.
Right.
Dusty was always my favorite. My other choice. The night before, you know, the day of my match, you know, you think of what your name's going to be. I wanted to call myself, I was a big Great Muta and Sting Mark. Yeah. I wanted to paint my face. And this is when Sting and Muta were in their feud. And I wanted, there was a techno song called This Is Acid. And I wanted to spray my face. And when the time was right, blow acid in a man's face, which would be my finisher, because I'm spitting acid in your face.
Yeah,
so you're
right.
going to, you know, face going to melt.
Yeah.
And you're going to be blind and you can't see me. So, that was going to be my name, Tommy Acid. And then when I told Johnny Rods that, and I started painting my face, he goes, what are you doing? And I said, well, this is what I want. He goes, no, you're too good looking to be that. He goes, like, this is your dream? Okay, you're Tommy Dreamer. I said, okay. And that's how that stuck. And it was a tribute to Dusty Rhodes. And it's how it's been my dream. Tom is my real last name. My real first name. And so that's kind of how that happened.
So how long-
I still think Tommy Acid would get over nowadays. I could blow acid in your mouth. And
okay,
face
okay,
right now.
Wow. Okay. So you're gonna put the acid in your mouth? It's not gonna eat up the insides of your mouth?
Yeah, no, I didn't think about that.
Now you could blind someone; it's gonna eat up their face.
I
could have
done like the
mouth.
Drano gimmick, but I could only done it once.
Right. Yeah. Hey, let's fast forward a little bit. Extreme Championship Wrestling. When you got in, was it still Eastern Championship Wrestling and was making the transition?
I came in the first day that Paul took over. I just showed up with my gear. Taz and I have been wrestling all over the East Coast. He got me booked for ICW. We wrestled a million times there. We were doing stuff that people hadn't seen before. Taz was, a little guy suplexing everybody. He would take me and suplex. I took all of Taz's early moves. Taz was like, I want to suplex a guy upside down. Dreamer, come here.
Right.
And so we had a match. I'll never forget. It was my debut match. And this is how crazy and good Paul is. We had a match. Three people at the end of my match clapped their hands. Gave me a standing ovation. Paul calls me to the studio, which is about 2 hours away. So I drive down and he goes, look at this. And he shows me three people standing for me. Because I could do something with you. I said, cool, man. I just, you didn't know where ECW was an independent. And Paul, on the first television show, he had all of the bad guys going over. Shane Douglas was going over. Public Enemy was going over. Everybody went over. Taz beat me. And they had Joey Styles end the show. He was like, ladies and gentlemen, they're, ECW is running amok. This guy's going over. He's totally, there's doom and gloom in ECW. He goes, what? Wait. He goes, let's go back to the ring. And he goes, these hardcore fans of Philadelphia that booed Santa Claus are cheering this pretty boy, Tommy Dreamer. Maybe there's hope for ECW after all. Getting goosebumps, even just talking about it.
Right.
And from that, three people standing for me, Paul saw something in me. And then,
but it took you a while before.
Oh, it took me a hell of a while.
Yeah.
I was so good looking. No, I was a good looking baby face. Again, that's what I thought I had.
You're almost the anti of everything that they were going to do.
They respected my wrestling, but just because of my appearance, I had a really good body.
Wholesome, good looking dude.
Yeah, but again, it was the 90s.
Yeah.
That's what I thought I had to be. My first job offer from WCW was to be the American Males. When Bagwell. And it was Bagwell and the Patriot, and Bagwell left. Kevin Sullivan offered me $75,000 a year for 2 years to be his partner.
One half of the American Males?
And I said no. It's a
God
good
damn,
thing
Tommy,
that didn't happen because all these conventions.
Where you been for the working, man?
Good. All these conventions, if I went as the American Male, people would say, what the hell happened to that guy? Because my gimmick would have been like a body guy.
Right.
Then I got to wear a T-shirt, so then I could eat and do whatever.
So talk about the key moment that started to getting you over as a babyface. Was it indeed the Singapore Cane match?
Yes. I'll give it all the credit to Taz. Taz said, Paul was pushing me, and I kicked out of Jimmy Snuka's splash. And first guy to do that.
Tell me about the uphill battle here, because you're fighting to become a babyface and you're catching on a little bit, but before you started getting over the top and before the Kane thing, I mean, how
it was a struggle.
How frustrating was it?
You have no clue. I would seriously.
Oh, no, I do. That's why I'm asking.
I would go to the fans and I would ask them, because we'd have a lot of repeat fans, and I say, what don't you like about me? Like, oh, nothing. We just boo the bad guys. I'm like, well, okay, but what don't you like about me?
Right.
My look. I can't,
Right.
I got to think, no, well, it's just, or people would tell me little things, we don't like guys who clap. We don't, you represent the good guy. Okay. It was a transformation. I had Terry Funk be like, Tommy, just be you. And he goes, they don't like your look, grow a goatee. And it'll make you look tougher. Now I grow a goatee to hide my double chin.
Right.
But it's, what do you mean, right? I'm svelte. No. But those little transformations, and like, it's funny. I remember one time, and this is how much I loved wrestling. I remember seeing like Terry Funk's eyes and how they were like droopy and beat up. And I remember punching my eyes to try to make me look a little tougher.
Grizzly, yeah.
And I didn't know that happened because of old age. know, I just, that was how much I was willing to do anything. And, and it was just these little things. But Taz went to Paul and he said, listen, I don't care. This kid will make, he's tough. And at the time, there was that kid in Singapore who was going to get caned,
yep.
And it was national news. And Paul's like, hey, let's come up with the idea of, you know, so the loser gets lashed 10 times. And, dude, I remember the first one, they cheered. Second one, yay! Third one, and now it's like, whoa, now they're seeing the welt on my back.
Yeah.
By the sixth one, the people who hated my guts, they used to hold. When I kicked out of the Jimmy Snuka Splash, I remember a sign. I'm making history, and a guy holds up a sign, Wet Dreamer. And I'm like, thanks, buddy. That's
you
only going to be up there for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So
we're at cane number six.
Now people, Tommy, stay down. My back is gushing blood. They're seeing the welt. I'm really crying.
Yeah. Now did they strap you down, or you just laying
no,
on the mat?
Okay. I would hit, and I would keep, you know, getting
gotcha.
Up.
Okay.
And woman was, you know, healing me, mm-hmm. and Sandman sitting there doing, you know, his gimmick. By seven, people are screaming to get down. There was girls crying in the audience. And then by the time I got up, it was so emotional. I remember looking at Sandman, and Sandman's bottom lip was quivering because we knew this was something.
Yeah,
and
I feel it.
He's really caning me.
I dig it.
This is, you know, I remember the movie The Passion of Christ, where they're depicting a caning. They're acting it. I was really getting caned.
Right.
And you look at, I go back and look at that now. That was a real cane. It wasn't gimmicked.
Yeah,
it was breaking on my back.
Yeah.
And I got up. And I actually took 11, because then when I turned around, son of a bitch hit me for the last time.
That was the key. You took the 10, and then you asked him for one more.
Yeah.
So did I didn't see it. Did he milk that?
Oh, he milked every one of them. They were like, woman kept saying, enough, Tommy, just lay down. Right. What are you fighting for these
Tell
fans
me about
for?
The 11 striking with the crowd.
Well, the 11th, after he gives me the final one. I remember what I said, but it's like, I took everything you got. You ain't nothing, blah, blah, blah. When I turned around, he suckered me for another one.
Right.
And he hit me so hard, the cane broke around and not only hit me in the back of the head, but hit me in the front.
Mm.
Split open my face.
Right.
So then right after that, what do? I'll go cut promos.
Right.
You know, so that was that, and that was the beginning of, holy shit, this guy will do anything for us.
Right.
And then the moment, and I can remember Paulie looking at me almost like a father proud of his kid, and he hugged me and he embraced me. It was the night I pile drove Beulah.
Right.
It was my feud with Raven, and he showed it all the time. I was in the crowd, and I was chanting ECW. My face was bloody.
Yeah.
I hit my pose. And he grabbed, when I came to the back, it was like seeing your son hit a home run winning the World Series of a Little League game. And he grabbed my hands and he said, once you're over, these people will believe in you for the rest of your life as long as you don't ever let them down. And I never did. And I think that still kind of goes to my relationship I have with fans. You know, we're talking about the House of Hardcore, of why it's been successful. I go out, everybody knows I'm real. Everybody knows I'm a wrestling fan. I never was above that. You know, it's funny. Me and John Cena have traveled together. Me and John Cena have gone to gyms together. We went to a gym in Wichita, Kansas, and this guy came up to me, and he was like, Tommy, you know John Cena's here? And I was like, yeah, I travel with him. People view me as Tommy from their gym, Tommy the regular guy, and it just happened to us. You and I just took that picture. The guy's like, hey, can I take a picture? He taps me on the shoulder. He's like, thanks, Tommy. He didn't ask for a picture of me.
Yeah.
He knew who I was, but he wanted the picture with you. I was never that superstar. I was the regular guy. But I remember, again, all those little tweaks and little things. I remember with Paul. Paul's like, you ever watch Arn Anderson? You ever watch Hulk Hogan? Hulk Hogan walks out there. He points to the top of the rafters, even if there's nobody there. So I would walk out the ECW arena, and I would look up. I would look to my left. I would look to my right. And I'd be like, wow, this place is packed. He goes, that gives you a great presence on television. That also gives you the presence that everyone's looking at you.
Right.
And then he'd be like, you ever watch Arn Anderson? Arn Anderson comes to the ring. Everybody's afraid of him. Guys want to punch him, blah, blah, blah. He'll give a look, and guys back up. What does Arn Anderson do as a babyface different? Nothing. Those same people that are reaching to punch him are the same people that are clamoring to touch him.
Right.
And because I remember when, again, a struggling babyface, I'd go out there, I'd put my hands to slap their hands, and the fans would have their hands there, and they'd pull their hands away. You look like a real douchebag on television.
Yeah.
But again, that was Paul just taking little nuances of different guys and giving it to me. What this business is missing, especially on the indies, is veteran leadership. I can look around. I used to travel with Paul Heyman. I had Mick Foley. I had, on the indies, I had Tony Atlas, who would help me all the time, telling me, kid, don't take drugs. Kid, don't do this. Kid, I'm living in a YMCA. Save your money. I had in ECW, Paul Heyman, Mick Foley, Terry Funk, Kevin Sullivan. How can you not learn in that locker room? I had Sherry Martel running around, you know, or talking to me, or, hey, Sherry, you want to take a car trip? How do you not learn from any of this? Or there's so many guys, I go to so many shows, guys don't even ask me to watch their matches. I love watching wrestling.
Well, when was the Beulah Pile Driver? That wasn't the same night, was it?
No, Beulah Pile Driver was now my feud. After the Sandman feud went to Sandman feud went to the Raven feud.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Man, did you see the ECW Barbed Wire City DVD?
I'm not sure.
I don't know, man. It painted it in such a... like a bunch of guys came out of a meat grinder.
Barbed Wire City. No.
Okay.
I never saw that one.
Okay, yeah.
I don't watch anything that's about ECW that's not... If it's not myself or Paul Heyman or...
Right.
I don't feel it's authentic.
Authentic. But okay, what are your thoughts when you look back at ECW? Because I came through there for a brief time,
right.
And it was a very interesting time. And, of course, you know, Paulie gave me an opportunity to learn how to cut a great promo.
Correct.
And helped you guide me through that. Of course, you know, when I first came there, I was trying to be a heel.
I remember it like it was Middletown, New York. The same night Bubba Ray got his job.
I said, what I see here is a bunch of violent crap. And I said, I'll call it exactly what it is because that's the way I see it, a bunch of violent crap. I was trying to be a heel. To the end of the violence. Didn't it get a little bit too much after a while?
Yeah. Again, wrestling was 90s. WCW, WWE are competing. They had their own niche. Paul went with violence to get people to watch us. And we became the South Park, the tape traders. Hey, wrestling is fake, but these guys in Philadelphia are real. Yes, when you saw that the Taipei death matches or all the tables or this scarred up freak named Sabu, but we were different. What a lot of people don't realize was most of us could actually wrestle, except for the Sandman. He was the shits. He'll be the first to ever tell you.
Yeah.
But he was tough.
Right.
And he was like the bruiser or the crusher. People believed in him. And, you know, from that we had Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit. We had amazing wrestlers. We had Rey Mysterio.
Yeah.
When our competition went one way, we would go the other way.
Right.
When you tell me this, I'm talking to you strictly from my old school ECW mentality. When Paul was amazing, and Paul also gave me, forget about what he did for me. He did everything for me. But it was creative freedom. It was, well, hey, instead of going this way, what if you go that way? Or Paul would be like, Tommy, you book the rest of the show. I was a little different, but Raven, Shane, Taz, we all had input to our own. We knew how to be us, and Paul would tweak it. And if we had a disagreement, he would actually sit and listen to us, sometimes change it, or sometimes he'd let you spew whatever you wanted to get out, and then at the bottom line, you'd still do what he wanted. But it was also the mentality was always for all for the show. Hardcore wrestling and all that stuff, it does get a bad rap for... Again, people think that we're all about violence. Some of the greatest wrestling matches occurred in ECW. I mean, you look at the guys who came through there or just had Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho did some amazing stuff. Too Cold Scorpio still to this day works his ass off on indies, but there was guys out there that just were able to go out there and practice their craft and master what they did for the end. We were not go out there in 5 minutes plus two intros and go do what you do. Paul would edit the shit out of it, or I'm going to sell it on VCR tape and go out there and take it. And our mentality, Rob Van Dam, Jerry Lynn, our mentality was if you couldn't top us or you couldn't top me on the card, you didn't deserve to be there. And that's kind of how we went. You know, it really was. And yes, I could say how we were escalating the violence and all that shit. A lot of people talk about me. Oh, you got chokeslammed through 10 tables. The record was 4. And yes, I would, I joke with Mick Foley about it because he took the one big bump on television, on pay-per-view, got paid a lot of money for it. I was taking choke slams off the cage in like Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, through one table, but we were building towards it. You know, it was first I got beat by a chokeslam. Then it was one table. Then it was two. Then it was three. But then at the end, we did that big scaffold match with Brian Lee, and there was the payoff. But again, people want to rewrite their own thoughts about it. I mean, also,
how was the real camaraderie back here?
Because it was awesome.
The one night when we were at the hotel, it was real late at night, and we got the promo. But you were there. Raven was there. Sandman was there. And just a bunch of guys there. Stevie Richards was there. But how competitive were you guys?
We were all fighting.
Were you all for the cause? Or all, you know, obviously, all I wanted
to do. As JR would say, a lot of us were drinking the Kool-Aid.
Right.
We knew that this was a great. If you think about what ECW was a developmental for the business. Guys would practice their craft, get over, and they would go other places. That's what ECW truly was. That's what ECW should have been. We all thought we were rebels. We all thought we were changing the business, because then here comes the Attitude Era. You know, a lot of times when guys, you know, here, you know, Sandman drinks beer. Oh, look, Steve Austin, they're stealing our shit. We did have that mentality. In 97, when we went to do the invasion,
right,
we thought we were actually, I didn't, but I wasn't too sure. And I remember when Jerry Briscoe, when we did that thing in Philadelphia, I thought we were there. Hey, brother, are we working or are we shooting? Jerry Briscoe wanted to fight me. And I never met this man. And he's like, you motherfuckers, you dare. They only told Savio Vega. JBL didn't even know.
Right.
And, you know, we were ready for a fight. We had plants in the audience. If shit goes down, guys, we're going to fight for real. We were that crazy. It's funny. I just went back to the Manhattan Center for TNA. And I said, man, I was here in 1997. We all walked in like a team. And I remember Vince being so impressed by it. And when we walked into that locker room, we were not perceived well, because we were taking guys' TV time. It was such a different time in the business. What I say this how I think then, but then later on to find that Paul was in bed with Vince all along, that's the heartbreaking part about ECW. Or the fact that ECW didn't have to go out of business. That is, you know, I had saved the company. I had millions of dollars offered to me, but they just didn't want to have Paul running the show, because as we know, Paul's a little flaky, is a nice way to put it. But, you know, I found out Paul was in bed with WWE the whole time on WWE Bite This when we were getting ready to do 2005 pay-per-view. And
so when you find that out, what do you do?
I wanted to kill him, because I lost
everything. Yeah, but you guys are on good terms now, right?
Yeah. We had
that was a funny, yeah.
We didn't have a fault. I was lied to.
Right.
If I looked at it, I don't have any malice or ill feelings towards him.
Right.
One, because of everything he did to me, for me. Mm-hmm. I don't like people who lie. He did not have to lie to me. I get why he did it. And I mean, I've straight up told him this. But again, ECW didn't have to go out of business. It didn't. But I think he was done.
Right.
And I mean, even like when he went to WWE, I asked him for a few things, like, hey, the ring truck was in my name. My parents were paying for the company. I lost a lot, you know, hundreds of thousands of my money and my parents' money. And I ruined my credit because of all that stuff. WCW had one. I remember this is towards the end. Dusty Rhodes had called me up and said, hey, Eric Bischoff wants to do an angle with, you know, because now they're getting their ass kicked. They want to have ECW invasion. And I was like, Paul, this could help save the company. You know, we're hanging on. And he's like, Vince will go crazy. I'm like, who the fuck cares about what Vince wants? Right. And then right then and there, I said, something's up.
Right.
And I remember in 97, I mean, we would go and we'd have meetings, and we went to the tower and we would talk about, you know, we're doing cross promotion, but it was helping ECW get on national television, you know, for our pay-per-views. And Jerry Lawler was the perfect catalyst for all that stuff. But again, in hindsight, you have no clue how people's lives change. It's funny, every day when I go on these indies, I will meet people who are like, it was the greatest time of my life. And if you guys could have just hung on. And I know he was on your podcast recently, and he, you know, we were owed a lot of money. And
right.
I just felt he gave up. And I stayed in ECW longer than the owner. And I thought I was an owner in the sense of, because all the stuff that I did, but I didn't have anything in writing.
How much of a hand did you have in the booking?
Oof. Paul took me into the studio in about 1995, because I lived close, and he showed me how to edit. He showed me how to book. There, I used to run all the live events. He wasn't even coming to the shows. me and Raven were kind of booking a lot of our own stuff.
And Raven's an interesting guy.
Oh, yeah.
One of my old travel partners, and what I haven't talked to him in a long time, but a very good friend. Very bright guy.
Yes.
And there were some great promo. There were some great characters,
yep.
Personalities. And I don't want to say characters. Characters, yes, but people.
Yes.
Cutting some great promos.
We have. I had.
Talk to me about a booking session between yourself and Raven, because the thing about Scott is he's so funny. He's so smart. He'll overthink things so many times. Yes. He'll go back to square one.
Yes.
You know, after he done went by it and made it better six times, he'll go back to the original
idea. The first run of him there was a pleasure because he was trying to get away from the Johnny Polo.
Right.
Everything was great. His second run, we kind of butted heads a lot, and I knew he was only there for a short term because he wanted to go back to Vince and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And he had also, you have to understand my mentality then. He left, I stayed, and
you were going to stick it out.
I would have, if ECW never went out of business, I would have still been there.
Right.
Still to this day. It was.
So what was that when the hammer came down and, hey, it's over with?
Worst feeling of my life. Suicidal.
Really?
When I tell you suicidal, I was
straight up.
I was 29 years old. My life was over. I felt I had nothing. I had no job. I went to the Hart Springfield show to say hello to Bubba and Devon, and Bubba is trying to get me a job. And Paul calls me up and tells me I'm starting with WWE tomorrow. Meanwhile, the whole time he was telling me that we're going to try to, save the company. We're still getting on television. And when I tell you Easy Dibbon had to go out of business, I had people who wanted, I was offered $110 million they wanted to purchase ECW, put it on television. The one thing that Paul did not lie about was these people wanted to take ECW, get the time slot, that WCW, and put ECW on there. They didn't want Paul running it because they felt he was shady, all that stuff. I was going to run it. And I straight up said, Paul, I'll never fuck you over. I'll be your boss. You know, I'm not going to be the boss. It's going to be exactly the way it is. And you go from $110 million. I just bought my dream home with, that's all I really want to do is buy my mom and dad a house. And I was living in it. And I went from the ultimate feast to the ultimate famine. And it's funny, here in New York, me, two other people that were running the business of ECW, we're sitting there and we're waiting for Paul to talk about here's a loan of $110 million. And the night before, he was supposed to fax something. He never faxes. Finally, that morning at about 10 a.m., he faxes a list of receivables, not what what they wanted. And he no-showed the meeting. And he let me look like such a fucking asshole in front of these people that are wanting to save. This is my life. This is my livelihood.
Right.
You understand, these are my friends' livelihoods. My hardest part about the wrestling business is, I guess from the premise, it's based upon deception, when it doesn't have to be that way. When I wanted to leave WWE, I straight up went to Vince and said, listen, I don't want to be here anymore. And I know you've gone through your own.
Yeah.
But I sat with Vince and I straight up told him I need to leave. And he was like, I don't want you to do that, all this stuff. But at the end of the day, it's not like I'm going to go on national television, beat somebody
right.
up. Let me just say goodbye, blah, 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 that type of deal. So I like to treat people how I like to be treated. And you don't need to lie and bullshit and do that to people. Because I've seen, when ECW went out of business, I saw my best friends. I seen their girlfriends leave them. You know why? Because they're not famous anymore. I saw.
Right up.
Yeah. And these are guys who, my one friend, I'm not going to say who he is, but he was thinking of proposing to a girl. And then all of a sudden, she starts acting weird because he ain't on TV anymore. Thank God he didn't marry her anyway. But everybody's lives were affected by that. And it was affected by one person's decision. And it's funny. Like in TNA, I'm fighting so hard because the business needs TNA. The business needs House of Hardcore. The business needs so many different things, because if not, the business won't survive. Honestly, I'm a big baseball fan. I like the Yankees and the Mets or the Yankees and the Red Sox, but I don't want to watch them every single day.
Right.
You know, I like diversity. I want to see new characters.
So what happens with the offer? the $110 million offer. You got the receivables in. You're at the meeting.
When you no-show a meeting, and bottom line, if I want that beer, if I offer you $110 million for that beer and you don't want to sell it to me, or you just, I can't buy it.
Right.
So it just, it went away.
So it goes away. You're suicidal.
The worst.
What were the other boys' thoughts? I mean, everyone was crumbled.
Yep.
Did you lose your house? Did you save it?
I had saved it. And about 7 months later, the crash of the WCW angle on television. And Jim Ross, during that time, and I'll never forget, and honestly, man, if I didn't have my parents, I probably would have either killed Paul or killed myself or both. And I was nuts.
Right.
And Jim Ross called me up and he said, "Hey, Tommy, it's Jim Ross. We're going to bring you in. I just need you to hang on, kid." And that was my only hope. And
really?
I was working tons of indies. I was depressed as can be. I think the only good thing about being depressed was I had lost a lot of weight. I was probably, when I went to WWE, I was like 228 in the best shape of my life. But just because I was so focused on, you have no clue. Actually, you do have a clue because you went from top of the business to breaking your neck. But then picture WWE dumped you and you have nothing.
Yeah,
that's where I was at. You know, you have to deal, and most people don't. I was 29 years old.
Yeah.
I wasn't even 30.
What was your thoughts when you first entered the WWE?
I wasn't in Kansas anymore.
Right.
I remember we did that angle where we, the invasion, here we come, and we turned, and then we joined with the WCW guys. I remember there was a specific moment where we had to practice our walk to the ring with everyone, and they made us do it like three times.
Boy, that sucks ass, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, we're coming from the fans. We had to go, how are we going to hop in? And I didn't realize, I thought they were ribbing us. I was very defiant, and that affected me big time in my, I want to say my first tenure in WWE.
Right.
It also, most people thought, when I first was there, they were wanting me to go right into the office. And I was like, well, I'm 29 years old. I like to wrestle. And this was when
they wanted you to go right into the office and what?
I don't know, work in talent relations.
Why? You were Tommy Dreamer.
But I was also, I was talent relations in WWE, I mean in ECW.
Right.
I ran the live events. I dealt with the craziness of all the wrestlers. I held together a locker room of guys who weren't getting paid and sticking razors in their heads to, you know, I was.
What were you guys telling everybody when nobody was getting paid down there? Hey, man, hang on, it'd be okay. We're going to get your paycheck next week.
We were all trying. At the office, at one point, was me, Devon, and Guido. We found out where Paul's bank was, and Guido would go there and wait to, and he'd, right before work, is there money in the accounts yet? And they said no, but the father said he's coming at like 2 o'clock. Guido would be there at 2:05 to cash a check to get what money was in and out.
Right.
And again, the suckiest part about ECW going business, our houses were sold out. You know, we worked the Hammerstein, which is the big building, sold out back-to-back nights, no television. We lost, you know, we lost our deal with TNN. And, but you know, Paul was telling us we were going to be on USA Network and we came real close to doing it. The one thing, there's a lot of guys who are bitter and I am not bitter because if ECW didn't go out of business, I would not have my children because I'm 100% all about wrestling. I never knew what love was until my kids. I didn't. It's funny. My own wife, Beulah, she said, I know I'd always be second to wrestling. And she accepted that.
Really?
Yeah. And she's a great woman for it.
Right.
Because I've said, why the hell did you even stick around with me? You know?
What'd she say?
And my large penis. No. she said that she knew I'd turn out to
you
be
sure
the...
You don't want to lay in bed and do this podcast?
I guess she, one of the nicest things that she said to me was, I always knew you were a great guy. And when I see you with our kids, that's the man that I always envisioned that I wanted to be with. And, so that was cool. It worked out for her. I always tell her she won the lottery. Look at me. I'm a prize. I'm an Adonis.
Hey man, through all the bullshit you guys been through now, how long you and Beulah been together now?
We were married, I don't know, 2000, I don't even know, how's that, 2004?
It's okay, nobody listens to this podcast anyway.
Yeah, no, 2000.
So what's your secret to the happy marriage? You've
I'm away a lot. I'm away a lot. The secret to a happy marriage, I want to say the best part about her was she was in the original ECW.
Right.
And it's funny. I was telling Edge this story where this was right before our first ever pay-per-view when a young lady was – I was, all again, all about the debauchery – servicing at least 10 of the wrestlers.
Yeah.
And I'm telling her the story, and then she claimed rape. And we had to go and find this girl. And then this young lady, who I knew, I found her in my friend's room who was passing out on the drug Soma, and she was blowing him. And his eyes were closed, and this girl was still going to town on him. And I walked in there with the police officers that this girl had accused us of rape and then disappeared.
Right.
And I said, I would like to press charges on that girl because she's raping my friend. And I'm telling Edge that, and he's like, holy cow. And my wife turns, she goes, oh, I totally remember that. She was there with me. And I can tell her, and I will tell her, what are you doing? I'm going to strip club. What are you doing? Well, I watched a midget and a giant bang a 350-pound stripper that I orchestrated. Well, me and Matt Stryker brought back six strippers from a strip club, and we hung out and blah, 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 blah. And, you know,
she's cool with this.
She was very cool with this, but she, she hit me up. It's funny. When am I going to grow up? And she's right. And to talk about how bad I don't drink. I never did drugs. I was always been straight up. My vice was always women on the road. And to tell you about the karma gods, I have twin daughters. That's how much I got double zing. That's how bad I was. A proud overachiever. But she has been there through thick and thin and always supported me. And she's awesome. She's still, it's funny. She recently got hurt at one of my House of Hardcore shows. And she got a bad concussion. And Lance Storm clotheslined her. And
Lance Storm clotheslined
her. She just took a bad bump. She hasn't taken a bump in forever.
Lance is like...
Yes, I know. Pigeon bones.
Yeah.
And she's been feeling the effects of that still, and this was a while ago. And she said, I'm 43, she's 44, and she said, I'm a mom, I shouldn't be doing this anymore. And it's a bigger picture. We have 10-year-old girls.
There is.
For me, going to the Manhattan Center recently, and I knew I was coming back on TV, and we're going to have this crazy hardcore war. And right before I left, she gives me a hug and a kiss. And she goes, remember, you're 43. I know you think you're 23, but you have two kids that rely on you. And I don't want to – if I'll take a bad bump or something, she's the one who has to deal with it. It's hard.
Hey, we're going to come right back next week with Tommy Dreamer. But this is a good way to segue out of the conversation and close this show. But we're going to continue this conversation right where we left off. I want to thank Tommy Dreamer to come to my little bitty tiny ass.
It's even more romantic now because it's at night.
The lights are down. It's dark. 50 totally Shades of Grey thing. We're holding hands, and I got beer. And who knows what's going to happen? I don't think his wife is going to care. Anyway, that's bullshit. We're two straight guys shooting the shit. All right, everybody, that's going to bring my conversation to a close with Tommy Dreamer. Part two is going to be coming next week. There's too much conversation just to fit into one show. Hell, we was crammed up in that little bitty hotel room in New York City overlooking the theater district there, having a good time. So still got to talk about the Innovator of Violence gimmick, his departure from WWE, and what he's currently doing with both TNA and his own House of Hardcore. Lots more next Thursday with Tommy Dreamer.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free. We'll be right back.
Yo, what's up, guys? This is NBA champion Bobby Portis of the Milwaukee Bucks, here with my brand new podcast, Keep It A Buck. Each week, me, AB, and Barrette will be talking to special guests from fellow athletes, celebrities, and friends from all walks of life. We're talking honest conversations with real people about their lives and what drives them to succeed. And you know we'll keep it a buck. Download new episodes of Keep It A Buck every Thursday. Coming soon on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcast. Keep it a buck. Peace.